Welcome to Charting the Course, a podcast from Full Sail Capital, dedicated to providing you with insights, assurance, and confidence to grow and manage generational wealth. Full Sail Capital is a fiduciary registered investment advisor managing more than $1 billion with a focus on integrity, competency, and transparency.
Welcome back as we record our next Squared Away episode. I'm joined by Zach Reynolds, our Chief Investment Officer, as he and I tackle both popular and impactful issues facing investors. I know you'll enjoy our conversation and hope it serves you along your journey. Zach, we're back here again for another Squared Away episode to talk about issues that are facing investors. Some of them, sort of like our last episode where we discussed GameStop, may not be terribly impactful, but they are interesting. Well, there's some sort of the opposite. They're long-term impactful, but not terribly exciting. Is it okay if we start with the fun ones?
Let's do it.
So cryptocurrency, non-fungible tokens, or NFTs and SPACs are really grabbing a lot of headlines. We've spoken about crypto before, but just summarize your thoughts on the space.
Yeah, so crypto, interesting technology. I think everyone can agree on that. The blockchain may have some interesting uses down the line. When you talk about the actual currencies that people are trading, so Bitcoin and Ether and Dogecoin and the others, certainly prices have gone up a lot, and that's gained a lot of attention, and we continue to get questions about it. Personally, I think it's really great if you're in the market for a black market transaction, if you want to buy or sell drugs or do other illicit things. That's probably a great use case for cryptocurrencies. And then along with, of course, just speculating on the price. You're betting that someone's going to pay you more in the future than you're paying today. That's not really how I like to invest personally. And the other challenge for us as just investment managers is it's cryptocurrencies are impossible to value based on any traditional value metrics.
Why do you
metrics.
Say they are impossible to value?
So they have no cash flows, for example. So in that sense, they're most similar to commodities. So gold doesn't produce cash flows either. However, gold does have some uses, right? We make jewelry out of gold. There's some industrial uses out of gold. So it's not like gold is ever going to be worthless. Now, could Bitcoin become worthless? I think as more and more people use it or own it, that becomes less likely. But there's nothing intrinsically valuable about a chain of letters and digits on a blockchain, right?
And so you specifically said Bitcoin. How many cryptocurrencies exist and what's their competition level? Does that make sense?
Sure. I think Google will tell you there's 4,000 or so cryptocurrencies, and I think there's more being created all the time. You will read some analysts saying, if you assume that cryptocurrencies take over the world and replace fiat currencies, so dollars and euros and yen, then, you know, it's a massive market, right? I'm very unpersuaded that that is a possibility, let alone a likelihood. So what seems most likely is that a few of them will gain traction and market share. Bitcoin was one of the earliest, so it's certainly got a lot of adherence. Ether has some smart contract technology built into its blockchain, which makes it really attractive for things like NFTs, which we'll talk about later. And then, of course, you've got your joke coins like Dogecoin or Doggycoin, as Scott, our colleague, calls it.
I like Doggycoin.
Doggycoin's a little
primarily.
Bit fun. And, you know, of course, it was based on a dog meme, a Shiba Inu dog, if those of you are up on your internet memes will recognize the meme. But it was created as a joke. It now has a decabillion-dollar market valuation. So there is real money that's been invested in this coin. Mark Cuban is one of the more well-known people who talks about it. But it's all quite weird to a more traditional view of investing and finance.
So along the lines there, David Swensen, the Yale Endowment CIO, has written before that the market runs on either fear or greed at any given time. How much is that true and applicable in this cryptocurrency space to you?
I think it's very applicable. Going back to the lack of valuation metrics for these coins, I think for me, that's a detractor. It makes it very difficult to be confident that you're paying a price that's appropriate for an asset. For a speculator, that's a feature. It's not a bug, right? Because you don't want someone coming in and saying, hey, your Bitcoin's only worth $20,000. You're paying $60,000. You want to be able to say, hey, I think it should be worth $1 million because XYZ. I mean, there's not really any real reason you can put behind that beyond, I think someone's going to eventually pay me $1 million for my coin. And then you mentioned NFTs earlier. NFTs, non-fungible tokens. I think that is another example of the fear and the greed and really the greed side of this. I think, and we'll talk more about what they are in the future, but it reminds me of kind of the Beanie Baby craze of the 1990s, you know, collectibles. An NFT is just something that's unique, but it's digital. It's, again, a string of characters. I don't know if anyone listening remembers CryptoKitties in 2016. That was a craze for a little while. A CryptoKitty, which is very similar to an NFT, just an online digital kitty, sold for $300,000 back in 2016. The average price today is about $65. We probably have relatives and parents who bought Beanie Babies and paid premiums, and we all know what those are worth today.
The Bitcoin enthusiasts are going to throw their hands up whenever you're comparing them to Beanie Babies, obviously. So how would you respond to those individuals who say that's just a ridiculous comparison and not fair, and you're comparing apples to Shakespeare?
Yeah, no, I think Bitcoin is different than Beanie Babies. Bitcoin, at least, is fungible in the sense that one Bitcoin is the same as another Bitcoin. So NFTs, though, which are much more collectibles, I think.
By their very definition, they are non-fungible.
Exactly. I think the Beanie Baby analogy applies much more to NFTs than it does to cryptocurrencies generally.
So you have used NFTs, non-fungible tokens, you've used that term. Could you define what it is and give us a framework?
Yeah, so NFT, non-fungible token, which probably tells you nothing, right? it doesn't really mean anything. What they are is creations that people can sell, but not in the sense that, you know, we go and buy a car, right? You're buying ownership of a digital string of characters saying you own whatever it is. So I think most famously, the artist Beeple sold a digital piece of art for $69 million. So there's real money that's being put into this space.
Well, there are other works of art by Picasso and such that sell for large sums of money. How is that different from the ownership of Beeple's digital art?
So the important difference here is if you buy a Picasso, you can hang it on your wall. If it's hanging on my wall, it can't be hanging on Tyler's wall, right? With Beeple's art, you can go look at it today and you can enjoy it just the same as the person who paid $69 million. So, which of course begs the question, why would anyone pay $69 million for something like that?
That was my next question. Yeah.
Well, the answer is it's cool on the internet. And that's hard to believe, right? But that really is the answer. I mean, the people who tend to buy NFTs, many of them have made a ton of money in cryptocurrency, and they are buying something that gives them credibility in certain areas of the internet. Just like someone who has really nice, a hedge fund manager has really nice tickets to the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. It's a status symbol more than anything else. And so it's amazing and weird and kind of interesting to talk about, but it's a status symbol.
One of the more interesting crossovers for me, any casual listener knows I'm a gigantic sports fan, but the idea of using non-fungible tokens to purchase sports highlights is just sort of interesting to me. And I'd be curious, Zach, if you just took your disciplined investor hat off, what would be a non-fungible token that you would like to purchase?
Well, as a former golfer, and I guess I still occasionally play golf, but a former competitive golfer, there's really only one answer. It's the Tiger Woods chip-in, number 16 at the Masters in 2005. I mean, what a moment. But I will say, I got to put my hat back on for a second. I can go watch that on YouTube whenever I want. And let's say someone did mint an NFT of that clip. You know, it would be cool, I guess, to say you own it. But again, I can go watch it on YouTube for free whenever
so
I want.
So my job when we do these Squared Aways is to ask what I hope everybody else is asking, because I'm sitting here going, I'm still lost in the idea of, other than the status symbol, you're telling me we could go buy, if it was minted, I could go buy the highlight of that chip in and I own it, nobody else can watch it, or I just own it, therefore people can go watch it. But to your point, it's on yep. YouTube.
That's the hard thing, I think, for a lot of people. So buying the NFT of a certain thing does not give you any copyright over that clip or anything else. It allows you to say that you own it. on the internet.
So just, it is not the same thing as owning royalties for music where whenever that song is played, you're making money.
Correct.
You're receiving no value from the replaying of that clip.
That is correct. Now, could the person, the cryptocurrency investor who bought Beeple's artwork, sell it? Yes. I mean, you could go sell your NFT to a higher bidder. So in that sense, it's similar to any other piece of art. You might have a collector who wants it more and is willing to pay for it, but it's hard to kind of fathom why someone would pay as much money as we're seeing being paid for something that, again, you're not going to get any cash flows off of.
One more question to both of you before we move on. Why are we seeing this in the marketplace for our investors? Like, does that make sense? Like,
yeah.
I feel like we're talking about something that should be in the category of a Beanie Baby. And again, not to offend anybody, but why is it coming up? Why is it kind of top of the market news at times?
Yeah.
So where's the crossover? And is it, if it's crypto, that makes sense.
I think there's a couple of answers that come to mind. One is, we're coming out of a pandemic where people weren't able to go spend their money going to sporting events, going out to movies, traveling, doing the things that they would normally do. At the same time, people have gotten wealthier. I mean, households have gotten wealthier, and particularly people on the upper end have gotten wealthier, including crypto investors, and they have a lot of money. And, you know, you could read NFTs as a sign of speculative excess. I think that's a relatively fair thing to do. The other thing that I would say, I mean, when I was growing up, baseball cards were cool. I think you guys probably were a part of that. And I'll tie this in at the end when we talk about SPACs. You know, people like collectibles. They have. And there's different fads at different times. I just like Beanie Babies. I know some people consider them an investment and spent their life savings on them. I would not want to do that with NFTs. I wouldn't want to do it with Beanie Babies. And I would be cautious if that's something that's of interest to you. Maybe take a very small amount of money and speculate in that space.
That's fair.
You mentioned SPACs in relation to baseball cards. Yep. Why specifically did you make that connection?
So a SPAC is an acronym for Special Purpose Acquisition Company. And they've been around, actually, the structure for a long time now. Think about a SPAC as a vehicle or a wrapper, just like you would an ETF, an exchange-traded fund, or a hedge fund. It's a term that describes something, but it doesn't tell you much about it. You can't really say, hey, SPACs are great investments or SPACs are poor investments. It really depends on what goes into the SPAC. The reason that they're becoming more popular is people want to create these SPACs or sponsors, or what they're called. They create these SPACs and they're able to raise a lot of money. They fill up this pot of money and then they go hunting for something to buy.
How limited are they in terms of what they are going to buy? If I were to invest in a SPAC, do I know what I am purchasing from there? So you said the wrapper analogy.
Right.
Do I know what is inside of my wrapper?
No, you would not know. I mean, what's inside the wrapper as an early investor is a pot of cash. Certain sponsors may be more likely to invest in certain areas. So SPACs were a popular way over the last couple of years for electric vehicle companies to go public. You've seen celebrities get involved in the SPAC game and be part of the sponsorship group for which they get compensated. But how I'll kind of bring it all together right now and walk you through an example of a SPAC. So the old baseball card company, Topps, you remember Topps, right?
Yeah. Yep.
We all had Topps cards when we were a kid. So Topps has been around for, you know, a long time. It's been public at different times in its history. It actually went private in 2007. It's a private company today. However, there's a SPAC with a ticker MUDS, MUDS. Jason Mudrick is the sponsor of this SPAC. So MUDS, the SPAC, has entered into an agreement with Topps to merge at a $1.3 billion valuation and go public. So the advantage there for the early investors in MUDS, the SPAC, is they're getting a company, they're going to invest in Topps. What's interesting about a SPAC is you actually, as an investor, have the option to ask for just your money back if you don't like the investment that they've chosen. So there's a little bit of optionality in there. But the SPAC has done well since this deal was announced. One of the reasons why, in my opinion, Topps is kind of perfectly positioned to take advantage of this NFT trend, right? They're a baseball card company. They understand collectibles. So just recently, Topps announced a deal with Trevor Lawrence. So Dexter.
Yep.
I certainly expect he'll be going number one in the draft, which is when it's coming up.
Thursday night.
when we're recording this. So it's very likely by the time this comes out, everyone will know that Trevor Lawrence.
On another fun note, I saw a headline that Trevor Lawrence has also signed a Bitcoin.
I saw that he received his first cryptocurrency payment. I saw that as well.
Which is also just kind of comical to me. That's like saying that you guys pay me in groceries.
That's indeed.
There was a NFL.
You give me money and I buy groceries.
I think it was a San Diego linebacker today that did the same thing. Some signing bonus or something. And you're seeing more and more of that. It's fascinating.
And you can't, you know, that's why we're here talking about this, yeah, right? You can't dismiss these things out of hand because they're out there. They're interesting. There's real dollars that are kind of behind these. But Trevor Lawrence's deal, they're going to have both a combination of physical cards and then digital NFTs. And if you own, I think there are 5 of them, then you get a special one. So, you know, you can see how Topps as a company is like, hey, let's jump on this bandwagon and make some money.
In a very broad, non-nuanced framework, you've got the investors in a SPAC, the company that is getting merged with, and then the sponsors. Why does each party enjoy or utilize this process?
Sure. So, from the sponsor standpoint, there's a lot of money out there. It's easy to go raise it. They're able to, as a sponsor, you are able to keep a significant portion of that equity. So that makes you a lot of money too. From a company's perspective, it's kind of interesting. So there's been a lot of talk lately about the IPO process. There's some people complain about the IPO pop. Traditionally, a company goes public and you know, stock goes up 20 or 40 or 50%, sometimes doubling. And some people will argue, well, the people who, the founders of the company or the owners, they left a lot of money on the table because they're selling shares. That can be true in some cases. It cannot be true in other cases. But this SPAC process kind of avoids that whole thing. You're not going to have to necessarily pay an investment banker as a company Topps to take you public if a SPAC comes calling and you guys agree on a price, right?
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, and this is a little, you know, Matt Levine, who we reference frequently on this podcast, has written about this quite a bit too. When you go through the IPO process, you have to register a lot of documents with the SEC. You have to be very careful about what you say, and you are limited in your ability to include financial projections in the future. A merger with a SPAC does not have that same regulatory oversight to the same degree. So Topps can say, hey, we think NFT is going to be a multi-trillion-dollar market, and so on.
Why is that? Is that because Topps is still private and essentially MUDS is unrelated to them? How are they kind of able to get around this, if you will?
It's a good question, Dexter. I think it's just differing rules between the IPO process and then a process where a publicly traded company is effectively buying a private company, right? It's a merger, but that's yep. more of what's happening.
So kind of tying this all together, what role do cryptos, NFTs, and SPACs play for the role of a diversified investor with a long-term outlook?
I've been pretty consistent on cryptocurrency, and I will say here that I'm always the first to admit I'm hesitant to even say wrong, but certainly we've been wrong so far, right? I mean, Bitcoin prices have gone up and up and up. I've been skeptical, and I've talked about my experience in the past of I've bought Bitcoin in the past. I didn't like the process. I have very deep concerns about Bitcoin or any cryptocurrency's potential as a form of currency, given the huge incentives that governments have to control their currencies. So, you know, for me, when I advise clients, I'm not advising them to hold cryptocurrency or NFTs as part of their portfolio. That said, as we've talked about in the past, some people like to speculate, and that's what I would describe investing. That was in quotes. In these different asset classes, it is speculation. As far as SPACs go, we will eventually see companies that go public through a SPAC in our portfolios, right? Because we're broadly diversified investors. Once those companies get added to indexes, we're going to be owners of those. So, you know, that process will play out as it always does. And I love the fact that, you know, Topps is going to be a publicly traded company now.
Mm-hmm. Do you think with some of the alternative conversations we've had around alternative investments, private equity, do you think any of those three topics, let's say, that you guys just discussed, will we start seeing alternative investment options there?
Yes, I think so. One of the hurdles when I've had clients ask me about you know, investing in, particularly in Bitcoin, has been there hasn't been a good way for a wealth manager to get their clients exposure to it. There are a few publicly traded options. None of them give you direct one-to-one exposure to Bitcoin in a cost-effective manner. So there are some hedge funds that do it at higher cost, less liquidity. There are some ETFs that do it, but they're closed in and they don't trade at NAV. So there's a premium or a discount relative to Bitcoin's actual cost. Tyler, I do think, and there are several applications out there, we will see a Bitcoin ETF that actually owns Bitcoins and tracks the price pretty well. It's only a matter of time.
Sure.
And that would make it more investable from my view. Okay. I'm still not sure that I would. For similar reasons that I don't typically advise that our clients invest in, GLD, the gold ETF. Gold has some use cases, but it's a commodity. It's a zero-sum game. You've got buyers and sellers. Prices go up, prices go down. It's not, you know, Coca-Cola that can grow its cash flows over time and its earnings over time. And, you know, Warren Buffett's done some great writing on why historically he hasn't invested in gold, although he's changed his tune a little bit lately.
I appreciate that, Zach. We're going to kind of go through some rapid fire topics on inflation, interest rates, debt levels. We're going to kind of speed through these. So as much as your econ professor would allow, we're going to go short answer here.
All right.
So if you could just give me some facts or anecdotes on consumer demand, household debt, government debt levels. What are you seeing right now?
We're coming up on a year and have been lapping 1 year since the coronavirus shutdown. Of course, last year, first two quarters, demand just absolutely cratered as the economy got shut down. Now that we're a year on, you're seeing just eye-popping numbers in terms of growth, in terms of sales and earnings and revenue and all of those things.
I mean, as we're sitting here, we're getting notifications of the aftermarket earnings coming out that are just
killer. It's earnings seasons right now, and we're seeing some of the highest increases year over year that we're likely to ever see, right? Which makes a lot of sense. That is a positive for, you know, stock market investors. The savings rate is pretty interesting. If you kept your job, you made money, but you had fewer things to spend it on, right?
Fair. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So your savings rate probably went up. If you lost your job, unemployment benefits were greatly increased, plus you got most likely multiple stimulus checks. So your savings rate increased.
Ideally, unless you had kids at home and you were homeschooling from home and buying any streaming service you possibly could.
Well, that's true. Fortunately,
But no, you are right.
How much do your streaming services cost, Tyler? What are you paying for here? Disney Plus is like $7.
I didn't have Disney Plus going into the pandemic. So there's $8 coming out of my pocket.
It's $84 a year.
Yeah. Divide your STEMI check by that. We'll talk about this later offline.
We do have Disney Plus now. That's not a shameless plug. It's just a necessity.
Your kids are lucky. But to put numbers around that, savings rate was, 7.5% or less going into the pandemic, and now we're double digits, 12.5% or so. That's a significant number. I remember back before the financial crisis when, we were seeing negative savings rates, right? People were spending more than they brought in.
Yep.
So from the consumer standpoint, they are very strong. And you couple that with pent-up demand that I think we're seeing coming out in all sorts of ways right now. That's a setup for an economy that's going to grow at a rate. We'll probably see GDP growth this year that is as high as we've seen since 1984. It's a long time, right? Yeah. So we're in for a very strong economy. Another thing you asked about, Dexter, was the government debt levels. And I think that's a frequent topic of concern of clients. It's been one, frankly, since 2009 when we first started increasing debt levels at really eye-popping rates. And we've, what we did back then now seems like a drop in the bucket relative to what we've done the last couple of years. You know, from my perspective, we keep a close eye on interest rates and the government borrowing costs. So far, I think it's fair to say that our economics textbooks have been wrong in that we've been able to borrow a lot more money than we thought possible with very few negative effects. We did see the 10-year treasury bottom at 0.5% last year. We're at close to 1.6% right now. So you can say, rate and interest rates have tripled on the 10-year. They're still very low. Mm-hmm. So it's not to the point where the debt service costs are hurting the economy in any significant way at this point. I think it is very reasonable to, if you extrapolate this out and we continue to borrow at these levels for a long period of time and our debt costs, so the yield on US Treasury bonds, increases to 3%, 4%, 5%, I think it's very possible that we'd have some negative effects from that. You know, we'll see what the politicians do, but the trend seems to be not toward fiscal responsibility.
Yeah, there seems to be no electoral repercussions for either party in terms of deficit spending.
I would agree with that. In fact, you know, let's be honest, it's popular. It's popular for people to get checks. It's popular for businesses to get PPP loans. It's positive and very popular for banks to get bailed out, or at least it was for the people who worked at the banks.
Yep. So I've moving on to kind of inflation. I've heard and read commentators say the Fed is going to let inflation run hot until we get closer to a long-term inflation rate more in line with their target before raising rates. So I just used a soundbite and kind of played fast and loose with a lot of terms. Can you kind of break that down, and what does that imply and mean going forward?
Inflation has been lower than the Fed's target of 2% for a long time. And from their perspective, and I think it's somewhat reasonable to say that because we're so much under where we thought we would be in terms of inflation, if we run it, allow inflation to run higher than that, so 2.5% or 3% for some period of time, we're basically just catching up to where we thought we would already be. It allows the Fed a little more flexibility as the economy comes back to let it run a little bit hotter than they might otherwise feel like they should. I think the Fed's in a really difficult position in a lot of ways because some of the things we talked about earlier, NFTs and asset price increases, you've got a stock market trading at valuations that are about as high as they've been since the tech bubble in 99. If you're the Fed, you're looking at all those things, and part of your thinking should be, do we need to tap the brakes a little bit at some point, or when should we tap the brakes to slow this economy down a little bit?
So the relationship between interest rates and fixed income products is very straightforward in non-nuanced terms. One rises, the other decreases. What about the relationship between interest rates and equities?
Typically speaking, if interest rates are higher, as a stock market investor, you have a potential alternative to buying a stock. You can go buy a bond, and let's say interest rates are 5%. Well, okay, get 5%. If it's a US Treasury bond, that's effectively guaranteed. You don't really have any real default risk. As interest rates go down and you're getting less and less return from bonds, it hypothetically makes stocks more attractive. A common line of thinking is that the lower interest rates go, the higher stock prices can trade because of that trade-off between stocks and bonds. I think that's reasonable. And I think it is a data point against saying, hey, stock prices are so high right now that, you know, we need to make significant changes, because put yourself in our shoes of managing wealth. If you sell stocks today, you're going to have cash, and we won't even talk about taxes for this exercise, but we're going to put it somewhere at that point. It's either going to sit in cash and you're going to earn nothing. Not only that, you're going to lose money against inflation. And as we talked about, the Fed saying, hey, we may let inflation run a little hot. So you're not only are you losing purchasing power, you might be losing purchasing power at an increasing rate, or you can go buy bonds. And, you know, we know what bond prices are. Interest rates are low, bond prices are high. So that's not a very appealing option either.
If I can summarize, bonds are facing headwinds. Equities are expensive, not necessarily overpriced, but at least expensive. So you can say they're facing headwinds also. What are my alternatives then?
Yeah. So again, I mean, cash, I think a lot of people feel safety and comfort in cash. I really try to challenge them on that point, because I think people underestimate the risks in cash of inflation, as we've talked about, but also opportunity cost. I mean, ask someone who sold out of the market in March of 2020 how they're feeling today, right? If they stayed in cash and they watched stock market investors make a ton of money, bond market investors made great money, right? Real estate investors, it doesn't matter what you invested in back in March of 2020, you made a lot of money over the last year. I do think, and it's something we spend an increasing amount of time on here at Full Sail Capital, that alternatives to public market investing can make sense for the right client. And the right client typically has a lot of wealth, has a very long time horizon, and has a high risk tolerance. But if the stars kind of align there, I think there's a case to be made for locking up some of your money in an alternative investment, whether that's private equity, private credit, or private debt, private real estate. Those are some things that make sense to me.
You briefly mentioned taxes. If you would, what do you sort of see in the tax environment at this point? Don't want to make you speculate because I feel like that would kind of be what it would be. But sure. Yeah, what are you seeing?
You're seeing proposals out there at this point when we're recording the podcast. And they're really only one way. I mean, tax proposals have taxes going up at this point. And there's going to be a lot of details that have to be ironed out still. But it seems certainly likely that ordinary income and capital gains tax rates could go up. They could do some other things with step up in basis, which would be a challenging thing to deal with for a lot of wealthy people, estate taxes. What I've been telling clients, and this is another hot topic, I think it's too early to take action. I wouldn't go buy or sell anything based on what might happen in these tax proposals. I don't think it's too early, though, to start talking about what we might do based on some of these proposals. I don't want to pay more taxes. I don't want our clients to pay more taxes. But if you're out there and you don't have a really good tax advisor, a really good investment advisor, and you think some of these changes are going to come down the line, it's probably a good time to start thinking about that. Because I think good advisors in this environment can create a lot of value, particularly if you're among the ultra high net worth. Because if you are, you are firmly in the crosshairs of some of these tax proposals, and the tax increase could be quite substantial.
Agreed. All right, we're going to end this one a little bit uniquely going forward. So I'm going to give you guys one question that you may or may not know that I'm about to ask you, but I want your off the cuff response. So here it goes. Given my focus here at Full Sail, which is retirement plans, when we, any of us advisors, bring you a 401k statement, what is the one issue that just gets your blood boiling when you see blank on a retirement plan statement? Either one of you can go first.
I'll go first. And I like target date retirement and life cycle funds.
Love them. Yep.
I do not like them when they are mixed with another product. So the idea is that this is going to auto allocate your equity and fixed income appropriately. So doing a 50% 2050 target date with a 50% S&P 500 fund defeats the purpose of your target date fund. If you want more, if you want more equity, pick a longer maturity target date fund. So that's one that gets me, is target date funds are great. They automate it for you, but you have to do 100% in the appropriate time horizon.
Keep it simple, stupid.
Or have a very good reason why you're adding some
Correct.
Other exposure.
Yes. I totally agree. Do it intentionally.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And that's the thing I think we see a lot, is that it's really hard sometimes to make rhyme or reason of why, you know, a person chose the particular options they did. I've seen everything from, you know, there are 15 options and they put 1/15th in all of them, even if, you know, they're all basically the same, or if they're completely different. Something that I saw a lot early in my career, which I started right before the financial crisis, I saw a ton of people either sit in cash or they were in stable value funds. And I think a big part of that is they're just looking at what's performed best lately. They're sorting Yep. by past Yep. performance. They're looking at what was the best performer. Back then, it was a stable value fund that was up 2 or 3%, right? Today, it's going to be a, depending on the time period you look at, it might be a small cap growth fund. And maybe they put all their, or the most Right. of their investments in there. It just, if you're not going to take the time to kind of understand what your exposure within your fund is, your 401k options, I think it pays to have a professional give you a second set of eyes and give you some advice. Or, as Dexter said, it's hard to give broad investment advice, but typically speaking, target date funds are a pretty good option.
They can be fantastic. Yeah. So, okay. Thank you for humoring me. Dexter, anything else before we sign off?
No. Until next time, fair winds and falling seas.
Thanks, guys.
See you guys.
All opinions expressed by the host and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Full Sail Capital. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. Clients of Full Sail may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast. If you enjoyed today's conversation, please review and subscribe through your preferred podcast platform. Have a great week.